conversations with students. You can use these learning targets that gives you the ability to have these conversations with your colleagues. Or even more importantly, to have these conversations with your admin. Again, one of the topics that's come up a couple times recently is how people feel about attempting something new, you know, based on some of their risk factors, based on all these other things. Well, here is a way that gives you some real concrete that you can talk to with admins, and you've been doing that, and your experience has been you're starting to change some of the admins' beliefs now. Welcome to the Grading Podcast, where we'll take a critical lens to the methods of assessing students' learning, from traditional grading to alternative methods of grading. We'll look at how grades impact our classrooms and our students' success. I'm Robert Bosley, a high school math teacher, instructional coach, intervention specialist, and instructional designer in the Los Angeles Unified School District and with Cal State LA.
And I'm Sharona Krinsky, a math instructor at Cal State Los Angeles, faculty coach, and instructional designer. Whether you work in higher ed or K-12, whatever your discipline is, whether you are a teacher, a coach, or an administrator, this podcast is for you. Each week, you will get the practical, detailed information you need to be able to actually implement effective grading practices in your class and at your institution.
Hello, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Robert Bosley, one of your two co-hosts, and with me, as always, Sharona Krinsky. How are you doing today, Sharona?
I am doing pretty well. A little tired. I have one of my kids traveling on his own internationally for the first time. My kids have traveled internationally, but this is on his own. And so I got up really early a couple days ago to kind of make sure that he got himself to the airport and got through everything. So a little on the tired side today, but other than that, doing well. How about you?
Similar. I'm a little bit tired because I've had a couple of big projects that I had to get done, which meant I put some late hours in the last couple of days. But other than that, not too bad.
We're back another week. What are we talking about today?
Well, today we actually wanted to look a little bit at another blog from the Grading from Growth blog. Now, we're not going to go into the depth that we went to when we did this a couple episodes back with Robert Tabert's 20 Small Things That You Can Start Immediately. We're not going to go into that level, but we want to look a little bit at this new post that actually just came out on March 25th, and then we're going to expand on it. So the post that I'm talking about, this one was written by David Clark. It's titled, How Alternative Grading Helps Me Support Struggling Students.
This blog post came out at a really opportune time for me because we're in week 10 of the semester. We're getting ready to go on spring break, and I definitely am feeling internal pressure myself. How can I reach my students? How can I work with my students? So to have a chance to reflect on that, I thought was very, very interesting. Do you have any particular part of the post that speaks to you?
We've done episodes on this before, this the idea of just being able to pinpoint where students are having issues, you know, not looking at a traditional grading book and going, oh, it's your homework that you need to improve on, or, oh, you know, it was test two, but not knowing really any more detail about that, but actually having the learning targets. And I think you talked about this when we were talking about Robert's blog, that, you know, how it changes your conversation so much. And really, this blog post by Robert's partner, David Clark, is just going into some detail about how he uses some of that in-depth information.
Exactly. And many of this we do. There are some things that I'd like to do better. One of the things David talks about is the updating the grade tracker. One of the things that we have learned that students in an alternative grading setup are very uncomfortable with is the fact that they don't know where they are in the class, how they're doing. I would argue they don't know that in a traditional class either, but they think they do, and then that's the problem. So,
and we kind of went into that with some of our buy-in episode, getting our students to understand so they can buy into, because this is, you know, it is different. Most students have been at least majority, if not mass majority, of their education has been with traditional grading systems. So understanding how it works does take some time. And, you know, we did a whole episode on this, and we both in our individual classes actually take a couple of different times throughout the semester to go back and kind of look at the grading structure and making sure that we're showing how a lot of times, you know, by week 5, 6, 7, students are locked out of grades. If they're not locked out of passing, they're at least locked out of, you know, maybe an A or even a B at that point. And we go into how with our grading, with alternative grading, and how ours is set up, no student is locked out at that point in our class. Like, I mean, you have to really get far into the semester before you actually get locked out.
And that's a critical point, but I think there's another one that we forget, which is, have you ever done a hike that you've done a whole bunch of times before? And so you know at every point on the hike how far you are along the trail?
I could say I've done that on trail rides, not hikes.
Okay, so that's true. You ride horses. So on trail rides, the point is when you're riding, and especially when you're guiding, you know exactly where you are on the trail. But the people coming with you for the first time, they don't know where they are. And especially if they're more inexperienced as a rider, they might be worrying about whether or not they're going to make it, right? Yeah. This is a fear. And I think that I personally have underestimated that fear for my students, because I see the path. I know the path. I know what the path markers are. They don't see it. They don't know it. They're kind of going along and having to trust me when I say you're doing fine. Whereas if they had the trail map and they could remember and see how far along they were the trail, and they're like halfway done or they're a third of the way done, that gives them a better sense. And I think that's what's missing in part from my students right now. We do hand out a paper-based grade tracker that shows when all the assessments are during the course of the semester, but there's nothing for them to mark or color off or move their little playing piece around the board so that they can see their progress. I think we definitely need a better, more visual progress tracker, and that's on my to-do list for the future. So that's something that's here that I like.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty substantial part of his blog, is about updating that tracker and kind of showing that pathway to students, not just because it's a new grading system, but also to give that clarity of, okay, if I was one of his students, I know where I need to spend, you know, my focus and my time on and trying to improve. So yeah, that is definitely something that I think any alternative grading course that's going to be successful has to do.
So the other thing that I have to do, as we've talked about here, is that I coordinate courses. So not only do I need to do this at an individual student level, but often I have two or three additional levels of this progress tracking, data-driven thinking about the course. And I think that's what we really wanted to jump into today. Are you ready to do that, or do you have something else you want to mention here from the blog?
Before we leave the blog and kind of expand on, you know, why having these learning targets and being able to track these learning targets specifically is so beneficial, I do want to kind of read his final thoughts, because I do think it's a really important one, and one that as an educator, especially if you're, you know, working in some of the environments that you and I both work in. So I just want to read this, David Clark's final thoughts. When meeting with struggling students, nothing is more important than empathy. They undoubtedly know that they are struggling. They don't need a reminder of that. But they do often need someone to provide structure, organization, and a clear explanation of what they need to do next, and a kind reminder that you know they can succeed in this plan. I think that's one of the biggest things. And again, one of those things as an educator that I've always tried to do, but I think when I was doing this with traditional grading, my grading system was actually counteracting that. I was trying to, you know, get students to understand, you know, that mistakes are good, and not to give up, that they can, you know, grow and do better and it's okay. But my grading didn't back that up. Whereas now with alternative grading, not only does it, but now I have that actual roadmap that he's talking about. Like you're not doing as bad as you think you're doing. You're actually getting, you know, these two learning targets. It's these three that we need to work on, and it's specific things about these three. So, yeah, I just want to remind us as educators that that's part of this, but that empathy is one of the biggest parts. And just being able to provide that structure and this, having the learning targets, you know, laid out as part of your grading system and being able to focus on those does that so much more than traditional grading did. Being able to look at it and go, oh yeah, you got a 45% on your homework. You should do more homework. That's not a plan. That's not a structure and a plan for a student to follow.
Exactly. So I definitely recommend people go read this. There's a lot of really good thinking on common situations and some other things. But like I said, this is coming at a really opportune time for me as a course coordinator. Because we're in week 10, we as instructors, and especially me as a course coordinator, I have a ton of data. I have data that is much bigger than any single group of 25 students. I have data from hundreds, if not thousands of students who've taken this course over the last few years. And especially since probably 2020 or 2021, somewhere in there, I actually have data that I'm capturing every single week about the number of students that have completed a given learning target. And that's where I'd like to go, because we're seeing a lot of this data. And the question is, how do we use it? What's the benefit? So I know you're more familiar with this thing. Can you explain in the K-12 world, what is data-driven instruction?
So yeah, data-driven instruction, commonly referred to as DDI, is this concept of using data from your assessments, whether they're, you know, formal assessments or informal assessments, summative or formative, but using that to actually guide your instruction, adjusting based on that data, based on what you're seeing. Can you move faster? Do you need to slow back down? What do you need to go back and reteach? Which again, I started learning about DDI and actually started using DDI long before I started my alternative grading journey. I was doing this back in 2009 and 10, when I first became department chair. We were looking at common assessments and we were looking at our data. So DDI is nothing new, but what is unique, again, because with alternative grading, our learning targets are laid out. And when we're grading things, we're grading on those learning targets, the DDI becomes much more focused and becomes much more, you know, narrow on exactly what it is that we're looking at and what it is that we need to go back and either reteach, or that we can go, hey, our students already got this. We had another week planned, but we don't need this.
Well, and I want to be clear, it's not just the learning outcomes, although that's the context we work in because our courses are standards graded. But remember that every alternative grading system, whether it's ungrading or specifications-based, you still have these clearly defined measurable learning outcomes that, regardless of what marks you're giving to the students or not giving marks to the students, you as an instructor are theoretically still tracking everything. You're still keeping a record of some sort of where the student is in terms of their work. So this is still applicable, even if your course is using a different flavor than a specifically learning outcomes designed grading architecture.
Like David's blog was saying, there's a lot of direct benefits to the students for doing this. But we want to get into expanding on that and talking about those benefits beyond just the students. So a while back, in fact, over our Christmas break, we did our winter break. We did a couple of replaying episodes, and we were doing it based on the things that we were doing at that time, because we were looking at making some changes. How does what we were talking about here with tracking these learning targets, how does that play into this redesign process?
So it's very fascinating to me the depth of conversations that I can start to have with people when we go beyond just a section level pass rate and we start to dive into these learning outcomes. So one of the first things that we often do is we look at section by section, how the individual learning outcomes are doing or not doing, because this allows us to give specific feedback to each instructor to say, hey, you know, your courses seem to be struggling more on this particular learning outcome than other similar sections. Do we want to look at how you're supplementing or how you're teaching this particular learning outcome, whether it's probability or sampling? So I get to really have conversations with the instructors first. So if there's anything that stands out on a section level basis versus the rest of the course.
It goes the other way too. We can identify, oh, instructor A over here is killing it on this one. What are they doing so the rest of us can take those same, whether it's an activity or a strategy or just an approach, and improve our own? So it's not just improving instructors, but it's also taking the instructors that are just killing it and taking what they're doing and improving everybody.
Yeah. And it's a way to very concretely say, hey, there's a best practice over here that is important. We need to look at that and perhaps transfer it. Exactly. So that's one way we use this data. And then we come together as an instructional team and we look at every learning outcome and say, is something surprising to us? So we have this entire course that includes both students who are deemed not college ready in mathematics and students who are deemed college ready in mathematics by our institution. So we look at a global level and say, hey, we're kind of surprised that this standard, I think years ago, it was like our fourth standard, our graphical summaries one. And I think that one is still one of our challenges, that our students just do surprisingly poor. You know, one of the things that we as mathematicians tend to fall into a mistake of is thinking that the material gets harder and harder through the semester, or that all the later material builds on the earlier material. And sometimes we don't see that. Sometimes we see an early standard, like our graphical summaries, that has a surprisingly low pass rate when all is said and done at the end of the course. So they've taken all their retakes, they've taken their final exam, and at the very, very end, only this many students ever got this standard, and it's one right in the middle of the course. So it's not where students are tapering off at the end. It's not that they're disappearing, although that's a part of the problem. It's just this one unusually low one. And if it persists from semester to semester, we know we got to make a change.
So I want to go back just for a second, just for clarity, because I know what you were talking about, but I think this is going to come up a lot in this episode. So I want to make sure our listening audience is clear. When you said students that are deemed by our institution as college ready or not college ready, what happens with those two different groups of students?
Okay, so a little bit of history, which some listeners of the pod might have heard, but back in 2017, the Chancellor's Office of the California State University System, which is 23 campuses and about 500,000 students a year, based on some data and some research, decided that we are no longer going to require students to take remediation in math before they enter college level math classes. And so our course is a college level, transfer eligible, credit granting course. However, we're not ignoring the reality that some students may not be naturally ready for that. And some, like naturally being, they're coming out of their high schools with whatever level of numeracy, level of success in mathematics. And some students are not at the level that we would typically have identified as being prepared and ready to be successful in a college level course. And some students are. Our institution uses multiple measures. It's a combination of some testing and some grades and some what courses they've taken. But we take all students into this course. And so every Cal State had an opportunity to decide how to best support the students who were not as prepared coming in. And our institution chose to do it by adding extra time to the course. So the course is typically a 3-unit course. We meet 3 times a week for 50 minutes, or it's 150 minutes of instructional time. Could be 3 times a week, 2 times a week. But the version of the course that is for students who've been identified as needing extra support, they get an extra 100 minutes of instructional time in the form of an activity section. So the idea here is that they are getting credit. So this is a credit-bearing additional activity where they get extra attention. They may have opportunity to fill in skills that they may be missing. So those are the two flavors of the course.
Yeah, and because I think it might come up in this conversation, but those two courses, if we start talking about them specifically, the 1090 course, or Math 1090, is the one, the supported one. It's the one that has the additional workshop, which is what we tend to call it, as a workshop, that has this additional minutes. And then the 1092 class is the one without. So again, both of them are 3-unit transferable credits. It's just one of them has that additional workshop to provide, you know, that additional support or remediation or just extra time, whatever the students might need.
And we have data from before we did this transition that the vast majority of those students who had been identified as needing extra support, the vast majority of them did not make it through a remediation pathway. And they dropped out of college at much, much higher rates. So the equity gaps between these students and the ones who were deemed college ready was tremendous. It was a huge barrier to college success. I think at our institution, the students who were at the lowest level coming in had less than a 9% final completion rate of this course, if you factor in the ones who didn't pass their remediation or the ones who finally got to this course but didn't pass it. They had a 9%, and now we're well over 70%. So it's just been a huge success, and it's still not succeeding as much as we would like. So we're always looking to improve.
So how do we use the data on these individual learning targets to do just that? You gave one way that we use it to improve, which is using DDI to look at either looking for best practices or looking for practices that might not be as effective, and, you know, using it either to beg, borrow, and steal an effective strategy to spread to the other instructors, or supporting that instructor or two that's struggling and saying, hey, what, you know, whatever you're doing, it's not working as well. Here are some things that your colleagues are doing. Maybe we should try one of these. So that's one way.
One of the key ways we do it is we do look at the differences between the supported and the non-supported class in terms of their completion on individual learning outcomes. So you would expect there's going to be a gap between those two most of the time. We'd like to close that gap. We very much would like to close that gap. But when one learning outcome has an even bigger gap than another one, then we have to say, what's going on? What is the skill that needs more support? And the one that is kind of smacking us in the face right now is our second standard, which is our standard involving samples and sampling surveys and identification of bias. And what we've come to realize is we're having a literacy issue, not just a numeracy issue. So this is statistics, it's interest statistics, it's quantitative reasoning with statistics. But it's very, very, very conceptual. It's very much trying to help students learn to critique the data that comes into their lives more than it is to have them actually generate that data. And we're seeing a larger than expected gap between both the two courses and a bigger gap than we expect between passing our first learning outcome and our second one.
Or the second and the third.
Or the second one and the third. So it goes down dramatically from the first to the second, but then bounces up. So our first and our third learning outcomes have very similar pass rates right now, but our second one is very low.
Just for a point of reference, our first three learning targets are kind of like the basics of data and where data comes from. It's looking at things like bias. It's looking at samples and populations. It's looking at differences between experiments and studies and what makes a good sampling or bad sampling. So it's all that kind of it's data, it's not statistics. And what's interesting about those is how much actual math is involved in these first three, like, you know, actual numbers and doing some sort of computational things too. How much is that involved in these first three?
So there's no arithmetic at all. There are some numbers in the forms of sample sizes and populations and sample statistics. So they do have to be able to see and read a number like a 38, but there's not a decimal in sight and there's not a fraction anywhere and there's no arithmetic, no algebra.
Yeah. So these first three are not mathematical at all. It is all conceptual on understanding how and where data comes from. So to have this one that's in between the two of them, that standard, that learning target two, have such a lower success rate, it's one of those things. It's like, okay, what's going on?
Exactly. We really want to figure that out, because if there's a way to adjust that, do we need to make that adjustment in the teaching? Do we need to make that adjustment in the assessment? Do we need to make that adjustment by filling in a support skill? Now, in this case, this also was very interesting because we saw a little bit of a dip in the non-supported class. So still, standards 1 and 3 are higher than standard 2, but the difference is just a couple of percentage points. There's a much more significant difference in the supported class. So 1092, the unsupported class, small dip, but a dip. And then in 1090, the supported class, much, much bigger dip. So this came up recently, and we're starting to look at why that is. This is something that we feel we need to address, and we need to figure out, do we address it for the whole course? And then also, do we specifically address it in the supported course? What's missing? What can we do?
Yeah. So not only are we looking at taking this data, this, you know, very specific focused data, and improving instruction, we're looking at it and using it to possibly redesign, whether it's redesigning the assessments, redesigning the unit, the learning target itself, or redesigning some of the activities that we do, especially in that 1090, that supported class. So all of this comes down to being able to actually identify where students are struggling. In a typical intro stats class, they have these concepts, these ideas. Usually that would have all been on the first unit, you know, and afterwards you could have said, oh yeah, the students struggled in the first unit. But no, it's not just the first unit. We know exactly, it's, you know, we know what parts they can do and where they're actually struggling. And then didn't you, like I said, we did those repeat episodes back over the winter break because we were looking at redesigning. And this data is helping us to find issues like that. Where do we want to redesign? But you also have been having some conversations. I don't know if we can mention groups. I know we won't mention names, but right. You've been having conversations and I think you're starting to turn some of them because they're like, okay, you know, this is really nice being able to have this kind of detailed information, right?
Exactly. So I was in a conversation with my group of interested stakeholders at the university. That's what we'll call them. I mentioned them before. And this week, they were sort of enjoying the conversation and they've started to enjoy the conversations because we're not anymore just talking about pass rates, but we're now discussing Lexile levels. So we have this challenge on our second standard and we're talking about it. And one of the questions that comes up is, well, is the language of the assessment, is the language you're expecting too hard? We are a Hispanic serving institution. We have a large number of first generation. We also have a large number of people who came up through K-12 in some sort of an ELD, ELL. I don't know what the current language is, but an English language learning environment where English may not be their first language or it may not be the language spoken primarily at home. So the question becomes, are we expecting too high of a language level? And I was with this group of stakeholders and I said, look, I'm a mathematician. I don't teach literacy. I happen to be an excellent writer. I happen to be an excellent reader, but I'm also a product of a success of going through this system that we know is not designed necessarily for our students to succeed. What I would like to do is I'd like to sit down with somebody in the English department, someone in the communication department, because they are grappling with, and they have my students. Our students and their students are the same. We are first year, first semester freshmen. And if everyone is taking COM 1100 or English 101 or whatever, shouldn't we be calibrating to an appropriate Lexile level that we're matching? Are we using academic language that's too high? Should we be simplifying some of our language? The other thing that we found out this, and I found this out before, but it keeps smacking me in the face, is sometimes we use language that we just don't know that our students don't know. So I remember way back before we redesigned the course, I had a slide that used the word minuscule. And my students stopped me and said, we don't understand what that word means. And I had to say very, very small. Now, it's not taking rigor out. It's not any of those things. But if you have students who are grappling with language, you need to make accommodations. And the one that we discovered this semester, we know to teach what bias means in statistics, because it means something different than in the general population. Like if I'm personally biased against baseball or something, it's I have an opinion. That's a different usage than the what we use in statistics. But we don't usually teach the word valid. We assume they know what the word valid means and that they know that it's the opposite of bias. Our students don't know that. So does that mean that we don't teach the word or don't use the word, or does it mean that we have to teach the word? So we're having these conversations with stakeholders at all levels of the university and bringing together beyond our discipline, beyond our department, and beyond an individual classroom in a very productive conversation to serve our students. And it was an extremely exciting moment.
It comes to this, you know, in the K-12 world, this is not a new idea, this what we call cross-curricular activities or cross-curricular lessons. Having our students work with similar things in multiple disciplines to see the connections and stuff, that's not just good for the students. It's great for the instructors as well. And that's exactly what you were just talking about. You and I are math experts. We are math educator experts. We are not necessarily literacy experts. But us being able to go and have those conversations with people that are, you know, literacy experts and saying, okay, we have this issue. We know it's not numeracy or not mathematical because there's no math. Can you help us with, is there a literacy issue? Is there a Lexile issue? Is there something that we can be doing to help our students with these? Because we've identified this issue, but now, yeah, we're opening these conversations up. And again, if I went to my literacy coach and said, hey, my students, you know, struggled on unit one on my last test, can you help me? They would have looked at me and laughed. But going to them and going, okay, these are the actual learning target. Here's what they're struggling with. I think it's a literacy issue, not a numeracy or a mathematical issue. Can you help me? Now they can. Now they can say, oh, let's look at the Lexile level. Let's first make sure it's appropriate. Let's look at, okay, here are some things that you can do, some activities that you can do, especially in that supported 1090 class that can build literacy. It now becomes a useful conversation and a really interesting partnership.
And what I like about this is this is not low-hanging fruit, because you do have to identify the correct people to talk to in your institution, but this is not a resource-intensive intervention. This is not going to cost the university tons of money and time and physical infrastructure to make this change. This is just experts being brought together in a room, maybe for a couple of hours, as part of the normal course of doing business, And then coming back, and I, as the coordinator, may come back and I may make a change to my assessment. I may make a change to my in-class iClicker slides. These are not huge lifts once we identify what the issue is. And that's been really interesting and exciting, because I also think then my English colleagues are going to be able to go back over to their stuff and say, hey, now I understand why, say, the California State Standards brought in technical writing, because what we're doing with our course is technical writing. So we can bring the two things together and get a lot more synergy. And this is also building towards another thing that is layering in, which is the career engaged technical skills. Our students are going to need to come out with certain abilities, abilities to read something, abilities to write something, abilities to analyze data. And if we and our colleagues are pulling on the same page and highlighting these skills across different courses, that's going to be extremely effective and important for the students as well, because we have learning outcomes that are not content specific.
Yeah.
So one of our learning outcomes that, to me, again, is a fascinating thing to look at is we have a quantitative reasoning learning outcome where you're trying to reason through the context and the words and the mathematics. We don't see a huge gap necessarily between the supported and the unsupported courses, but we do see a gap. It's 10, 12 percentage points. So that's another area where maybe we need to look at this and say, hey, we need to put in some more support structures on learning on how to make an argument, on learning how to read the contextual information on a problem.
And not only that MP1 that you were talking about, we also have one about constructing a viable argument and critiquing the argument of others. And yes, if you're a K-12 educator, that should sound really familiar. We stole that directly from the Common Core mathematical practices. But that's another one where, again, we do see a dip between that one and the other non-statistic standards. But isn't that gap bigger in the 1090 and the 1092, or is that one the similar one?
It's what's interesting is the gap is similar, but the overall pass rate in both courses is significantly lower. So all of our students are struggling much more with argumentation than they are context, but the gap between the two is much more stable. So again, this is the different kinds of data we can look at.
Yeah. So here's an issue that isn't specific to our 1090, our students that are coming in with possibly some, you know, more gaps or more things that need to be supported. Here's one that's universal for all of our students, this ability to make a claim, pick a piece of evidence, and explain how that evidence supports your claim, that argument. So there's something that, okay, we know we need across the board. But here's what I also think is really interesting about all of this that we've been talking about. This conversation of our pass rates and trying to get our pass rates up and stuff has been happening for a while, but it's been more intensive this year. And again, when I say that, I don't want people to think our course has, you know, a 40% pass rate. It's actually pretty high, but comparing us to other math 1000 level courses or entry freshman level courses.
It's not as high as some other ones.
Yeah. But a lot of those suggested things that we need to do to improve coming from mathematicians, what have all of those been?
I don't even want to reiterate some of them.
Bring back intervention.
Yes. Bring back remediation.
We got to do remediation. We've got to do, and not just remediation, remedial math. We've got to work on these math skills. We got to go back to seventh grade and teach, you know, fractions, percentages, ratios, proportional thinking. We've got to do all this math stuff with our data where we can now start to show it's actually not as much of the math that's the problem. In fact, if you look at our most mathiest, I'm not sure if that's a word. It is now. The mathiest of our learning targets, which is our one about probabilities. That's where our students do by far the most amount of actual calculations of things. Yes, it's probability. So I love probability, but I don't think it's the most intensive one. But what do we see with our data, both in our supported 1090 and our unsupported 1092 class with that specific learning target?
So in both classes, there are 10 content learning outcomes. That probability one has the fourth highest pass rate.
In both. I love this, you know, and I don't want to pick on my math colleagues because I think it would be the same for any discipline. But the first thing we think of when we say, oh, what can we do to get our pass rates up? Oh, let's go teach more content. Let's go back and reteach content. Let's go back and reteach these math skills. Well, no, what we're actually showing, and we can show because we can look at more than just simple pass rates, is our issue might be as much, if not more, a literacy issue than a numeracy issue. And that's something those remedial courses ain't even gonna come close to touching.
So another thing that's interesting here is the biggest gap between the two classes is in our Triple P standard. That's the biggest gap.
It's interesting that you remind people. I know we talked about this a little bit, especially with our Gusky interview, which he seemed to be really excited about that, which I don't know about you, but coming from Gusky, coming from that someone that I find as high regard as Gusky and him being impressed with that, like, made my year.
Yeah. So our Triple P learning outcome, one of the things that I argue is that one of the things I want my students to learn in every single class I teach is how to learn. That's probably the most important skill I can teach my students is how to learn. And one of the ways that I feel that you learn, or the biggest way that I feel you learn, other than from feedback loops, is by doing some combination of preparing for class, participating in class, and practicing after class in some combination. And that combination is going to change for every student. So what we've done is we've created this bucket where all the things you do, where you're not showing evidence of learning, you're just, I mean, there might be evidence of learning in there, but we're not checking for that.
Those activities that are meant as building a student's towards that proficiency.
Right. So they're all lumped together. There's this huge pot of, I call it like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, or the pot of points in the game that you play. Like I play a million of these Candy Crush type games and you get points all the time. There's like, I don't know, 1,000 points, 1,200 points, something available. And every activity has some number of points associated with it. And it varies based on my judgment as the instructor as to which things are more valuable to you as the student and which ones are bigger and which ones are smaller. So students are just supposed to do these things. And the vast majority of them are graded on completion. If you do the activity, you get credit for having completed it. So the fact that the gap between our supported students and our non-supported, that our non-supported students have incredibly high rates of completion of getting enough points and our supported students do not, really is shocking to me, because this is the one that's pure compliance. It's just do the stuff, do enough stuff. And you only have to do like 55% of the stuff or 60% of the stuff to get completion. And they don't. They're very low rates of completion. Now, you don't have to get this learning outcome to pass the class. So we're not making like passing completely dependent on this one thing.
Well, it's not even just passing. Like a student can get an A in our class without having that.
Exactly. So we're trying to minimize the overwhelmingness that currently assignments and late assignments and all that kind of stuff has compliance grading. And yet, for some reason, our supported class, the students in the supported class, they're not doing the work. And I think that's one of the big reasons they're not getting the results that we want. So I don't know how to talk to the students in a different way, but this is an area we have to start to explore. How can we get students to recognize the need for doing this work?
Well, and I kind of think that might go back to that closing quote that was in David Clark's post about the empathy and giving our students that structure and the kind of pathway with the empathy and the support to say, this is doable. So I don't know if we need to look at how we do that more, but, and I also would be curious to kind of look at, because one of the things we've talked about with that triple P is oftentimes the students that get it don't just get it. Like, they go so far beyond what they needed to do. And my theory, and again, unsupported personal belief, but my theory is because by the time they get enough points to get the learning target, is they've also realized it's what's helping them get proficiency on the learning targets on the checkpoint. So they continue to do it knowing they don't have to do it anymore. They're doing it because they've learned this is what helps me actually learn the materials.
Exactly.
So I'm curious if that spread, if those of in that support in the unsupported class versus the supported, those that get it and go beyond, I'm curious to see what percentage, and maybe that's something that we should look into when we're talking about possibly redesigning for this learning target.
Yeah, definitely. So I love the fact that, you know, we've talked before about the reason we stay with this change is the change in conversations with the students. I am now seeing that my conversations with my instructors have changed. My conversations with my administrators have changed. My conversations with my community has changed. This whole podcast, we're talking about statistics, both in our course, but then the statistics that we're calculating to analyze our course. So for me, it's a joy to get to say, oh, I see this huge difference. Which learning outcome is that? Oh, that's our triple P. Huh. What can we do differently? What do we need to change? What can we try? What can we test? Or, you know, oh, look, our S10, which is our hypothesis testing, that's so low. Is it that it's just so late in the course and there's not enough time for mastery? I mean, we teach it in week 12, week 13. That only leaves 3 weeks. Do we need to be looking at our content curation again, like we did with, we heard from Jeff Shinsky, who's going to talk about this at the grading conference. There's so many rich conversations that we get to have. And we're not just sitting here saying, well, you know, this DFW rate, is it because they're poor? Is it because they're this? It's because they're that.
It's because high school teachers intentionally don't prepare students.
Are not teaching. Yes. Well, you know, if you high school teachers would do your job, maybe we
Okay, please understand the sarcasm that was in that. we're gonna get burned.
We're gonna get hate mail. Let's remember that I actually respect K-12 teachers as having far more training in pedagogy and instruction than I do.
Yeah, so, that was an inside joke because someone actually did say that.
Someone said that in front of me recently, so that was interesting. Anyway, but yeah, this is just a joy up and down, and I really appreciate those stakeholders that have been meeting with me all semester who started out very skeptical of the system, thinking that alternative grading was more of a problem than a cure, and now are greatly enjoying the depth of analysis that I can do while the semester is still going on. I mean, we have opportunities. We could even make changes now. We could look at the pass rates on our standard two and say, hey, guys, we're going to throw another assessment at you. You have another opportunity. We can do that. You know, we have that flexibility. We have that opportunity. And we've done it before.
Yeah. And it doesn't hurt the students that do have proficiency or mastery in it already, because they just don't have to do it. I mean, but you know, going back to what you were saying, yeah, I've said this 1,000 times. What sold me on this after that first time I tried it and had such a disaster was the conversation with the students. But like you said, this is not just conversations with students. You can use these learning targets. It gives you the ability to have these conversations with your colleagues. Or even more importantly, to have these conversations with your admin. Again, one of the topics that's come up a couple times recently is how people feel about attempting something new based on some of their risk factors, based on all these other things. Well, here is a way that gives you some real concrete that you can talk to with admins, and you've been doing that. And your experience has been, you're starting to change some of the admins' beliefs now, that seeing this benefit of being able to have such focused and precise conversations about exactly what students know and don't know, and not, oh, they're not doing homework, or, oh, they did really bad on unit two. It wins people over. I mean, these conversations are so important that not just with students, colleagues, admin, the conversations continue to go on. So I can't stress enough how these conversations, which would not be possible without the grading structure of this focused learning targets and, you know, grading, using those four pillars to really pinpoint those learning targets.
I would like to invite everyone listening to this to make sure to come be a part of the conversation by joining the grading conference. I mean, we've gotten so much of this information on how to do this, on how to have these conversations, from having these conversations with people at the grading conference. So I just really think it would be a great place for everyone to join us who's listening, regardless of your discipline, regardless of your level. I know we may have some elementary school teachers who've reached out and it's like, am I going to get anything out of this? And I think this is just a wonderful place to have these exact conversations and to get the support so you can have these conversations with your stakeholders.
Yeah.
So I think we're coming up on time. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share?
No, I just want to thank everybody. You know, our listenership it's an unbelievably flattering to see that people keep listening to us. And I really do. I said this, I think, a couple episodes ago, I want to say it again. If you are a primary educator, a elementary or even early middle school, we really do. We want to try to be more inclusive with this group just because of our networks and our influences. We've talked to a lot of higher ed and some high school. We want to try to get more of that, of those primary levels in. So if you're listening to this, or you know someone that is in those primary levels and does this kind of grading, we would love to talk to you. If you don't want to be on air, you just want to send us some emails or voicemails, we'd love to respond to those. But especially if you are willing to come on, we'd love to have
you. And you can just contact us at the Contact Us form at our website, which is thegradingpod.com. So with that, I think we're going to sign off, and we will see you next week. Please share your thoughts and comments about this episode by commenting on this episode's page on our website, www.thegradingpod.com, or you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. If you would like to suggest a future topic for the show or would like to be considered as a potential guest for the show, please use the Contact Us form on our website. The Grading Podcast is created and produced by Robert Bosley and Sharona Krinsky. The full transcript of this episode is available on our website.
The views expressed here are those of the host and our guest. These views are not necessarily endorsed by the Cal State system or by the Los Angeles Unified School District.